Hi, welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. Have you ever thought about trademarking your race's name or logo? Well, trademarking your race and brand could help protect your business against trademark infringement and the risk of getting someone else's event confused with yours, whether that is done through malice or ignorance. Well, today, we're going to be looking at all aspects of trademarks and the trademark registration process with the help of no less than three distinguished guests. Brian Gallant of Sinister Sports, who had to defend his own race trademark against a competing claim not too long ago, and intellectual property lawyers Suzanne Schovold and John Deppi, who will be bringing the legal expertise in today's highly technical subject. We're going to be looking at the process of registering a new trademark, defending a registered trademark you own against infringement, as well as the many protections afforded to your brand by law, even in the absence of a formal trademark registration, through the concept of common law trademarks. So stick with us to have all your trademark-related questions answered. Before we go into all that, though, a quick reminder, as always, of how today's podcast was made possible through the support of our amazing sponsors. So many thanks to Run Sign Up, Race Director's favorite all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events, now powering more than 26,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events. And many thanks to RaceCheck, whose free RaceCheck review box widget can help you collect and showcase your participant feedback on your own website, helping you more easily convert website visitors into paying participants. We'll be hearing a bit more from these two great companies a little later in the podcast, but now let's dive into our trademarks discussion with Brian Gallant, Suzanne Schovold, and John Deppi. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Thomas, for having me.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on. Can you tell our audience a little bit about where you're based?
I am in Crow's Nest Pass, Alberta, which is in the south end of the province in the Rocky Mountains of Canada. And I've been a race director for 21 years now. And we focus primarily on ultra and trail races and marathons.
Awesome. I think in your case, we need to also mention the name of the company, which is a super cool name. What is it called?
We are Sinister Sports Inc., and that comes from our landmark race, Sinister 7 Ultra, which comes from the Seven Sisters Mountains just west of town.
Excellent. How's racing? How's business these days?
It is actually a really great year. You know, things have completely rebounded from the last 2 years where we were largely shut down. In 2020, we didn't work at all. I think we maybe had one tiny race of 40 people. And then last year, we had about half the number of people we normally would. And this year, it's as good as it could ever be.
Fantastic. Well, let's hope that keeps up. Now, we also have with us today, Suzanne Schovold, joining us from Canada, and John Deppi, joining us from the US, who are going to be the legal experts in today's discussion. We're going into a very technical topic today, and it's good to have at least a lawyer or two around. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We can definitely all benefit from your expertise. Do you want to maybe introduce yourselves a little bit to the audience? Tell us a little bit about yourselves, maybe starting with Suzanne.
Sure. Thanks, Panos, for the opportunity. So I am also in Alberta. I'm just about an hour and a half east of where Brian is located. I am a trademark lawyer, patent lawyer here in Lethbridge, Alberta, in the south end of the province. I can see the Rocky Mountains from here, but I'm not lucky enough to get to live in them. And nor do I do the races that Brian's company sets up. I have friends, certainly, who have done them. And I know the mountains of which he speaks, but I don't try to peak seven of them in a day. That's too much for me. I've been a trademark intellectual property lawyer generally. So we do more than just trademarks, although that's what we're focusing on today. For about 15 years, started in Edmonton, north of the province, and then generally slowly moved south for the nicer weather and to be closer to the mountains. And I hope that my goal here today comes across, which is to explain the language of trademarks. As you say, it is a technical topic. It's something that people don't necessarily understand. I get lots of calls for people who want to patent their brand, and that's not a thing and can't be done. So I hope today that we can get across to your listeners what it is that what we do and how to protect their brand and their slogans and their logos properly and to do so without the headaches that Brian unfortunately endured at no fault of his own, obviously.
Absolutely, because we should say actually that you were the lawyer who helped Brian trademark his races, and we're going to go into some of the history of that, which is quite interesting. And you looking at the Rockies, I guess, is that the connection with John? I mean, they run all the way down to you, John, down in Denver, where you're based.
That would be quite the race if you did that. So yeah, I'm based outside of Denver, also in the mountains, relatively new transplant to the mountains, and so at 8,300 feet, I'm ready to test out my altitude training in one of Brian's races for sure. So yeah, I live in Denver. I've been practicing, as Suzanne said, intellectual property law generally. I'm at the firm Holzer Patel Drennan here in Denver. I've been practicing about 12 years. And yeah, I have a wide variety of trademark clients from a lot of different industries with a lot of different products and services, and hope to shed some light on the mystery that is trademark law.
Fantastic. And again, I should thank you both for taking the time to be with us today. So let's start with the most basic question of all, and whichever one of you prefers can start us off on that. What is a trademark? I think people may even have some misconceptions around that.
Yeah, so I can jump in. So a trademark is an identifier of a source of a good or a service. That's the technical legal definition. And Suzanne might pitch in on differences in Canada, but in the US, the rationale for providing protection to brand owners in their trademarks is actually consumer protection. So as a consumer goes to the store or goes online to try to find a race or any product or service generally, they want to be able to have genuine goods or services and know the source of those, which is why the government provides protection in those brands. It's a consumer protection rationale.
That's true. And it's the same in Canada. So there are slight different, well, I shouldn't say there are slight differences. There are quite a few differences between the process in Canada and the United States, the technical steps that you go through to protect yourself, your brand, and your consumer goods. But what John is saying is the same in Canada. The idea is, do you have a slogan, a logo, or a name that you use to market your goods or services, so your products or the services that you provide to the public? And if so, then you have what we call a trademark. And it's a very broad definition. The Trademarks Act in Canada was just revised recently in 2019 to include a large number of things. So it's not just words or logos, but it can in fact include designs, tastes, textures, moving images, modes of packaging, holograms, sound, scents, et cetera, et cetera. So that brings us more in line with what the US already had, the ability to trademark, but that's newer for us, that it really is anything that you're using to promote your products and services to the public.
And just to pick up on John's point, I guess at least the consumer protection aspect of why trademarks were introduced is that, so, you know, when I go to a store and I pick up a can of Coke or something, I know that I'm drinking Coca-Cola or something, right? And that someone can just pick up a can, slam the same logo on it, and start selling Coke under a different, a different company, same brand name, right?
That's exactly right.
That's it. And it all comes down to confusion. So the consumer protection element of it is that I want to know the source of my goods. And historically for us in Canada, we can date trademarks right back to the Queen, where she was ordering her family was ordering steel for their swords. And they wanted to know that it was coming from the appropriate steel maker with adequate strength and quality of goods. And so they would stamp their logo on the swords, and the crown would know that they are in fact obtaining the source of swords that they want. And obviously, being in Southern Alberta, we have a lot of ranching community here. And that's another common place that people see it, where you use it to actually brand your cattle, and you know that it's AAA Alberta beef if it's got that particular logo branded on it. So that's exactly it. It's confusion, or to prevent lack of confusion in the public, to prevent the confusion in the public.
Yeah, and we'll go into the confusion, actually, a point which is also very pertinent for events as well. And we'll go into a couple of examples. So trademarks, as you say, they have all different aspects to them. And you can trademark, you know, like senses and feels and whatever these days, I guess. If we want to narrow this down a little bit to events, I see lots of confusion. We have a Race Directors group on Facebook, Race Directors Hub, and people discuss these things often. And I see lots of confusion around what can be trademarked about an event. You know, like people, you know, obviously may know that a name might be trademarked, but they don't know whether specific processes can be trademarked or other aspects of the event. So can we clarify that a little bit for people and also nuance it if there's differences between Canada and the US on that?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, generally, you know, anything that the consumer is going to encounter and either purchase or receive as a associative product with the race can include a trademark. The race itself, right? The organization, the services that go along with all of the event and what's provided to the participants. Obviously, that's a service that's provided and can have a brand. You know, that same brand can be provided on goods that are either distributed or sold in connection with the race. So t-shirts, water bottles, you know, whatever other accessories or products that they get distributed in association with that race. I'd say that's probably the two primary aspects that come along. But, you know, if you had other products, like let's say you had a nutrition line that you distributed at the race, right? You could trademark that particular nutrition supplement or what have you. So really anything that the consumer encounters can be trademarked with that appropriate branding.
That's the same in Canada. There are under our Trademarks Act and according to the common law, which is how we refer to the case law. So where judges in Canada, the federal court have made rulings on particular trademarks not being registrable. There are certain things that cannot be protected. And those are so not necessarily relating to the product. So as John's saying, pretty much any product or service can be protected. It's more so the brand or the logo or the trademark that you're using that is limited. So for example, you can't describe your endurance race as Brian's endurance race because you cannot use someone who is living or has passed away in the last 30 years, their name or their surname. That's not a trademark. That's just what he does. That's what his company does. You cannot clearly describe the goods. So you can't have exclusive use of words that are commonly used in common parlance. So endurance races, that's not the brand, that's the event. That's what's happening. So you wouldn't be able to use the words endurance race in your logo, in your slogan, in your trademark. You can't be deceptively misdescriptive. So where this comes up, for example, is to describe something, let's say, as an organic product. So you have organic in your brand name somewhere, but in fact, the product is not organic. Or you use the word titanium to describe something, and there's in fact no titanium strength in there. You cannot use places of origin. So I couldn't have Lethbridge in my brand, which comes up with Brian's Canadian death race mark, which we can talk about down the line. You can't have words in other languages. And obviously, as we've discussed, you cannot register something that is confusingly similar with something that's already out there. So there are limits to the mark that you can protect. But as far as the goods and services go, it's really whatever it is that you're selling, provided that you describe it adequately and, you know, you give it a good enough description of what it is that you're making and selling.
I think it's also important to point out that the ideas possibly behind the races aren't really protectable as trademarks. So for example, you know, Brian has the Seven Peaks, you know, the different, you know, the race that he has there. And kind of as a local example here in Colorado, there's the triple bypass race, right? Where it's a bike race that goes over three different mountain passes. I could organize an identical race that has the same route, goes over those same passes, call it something different, and still get, you know, trademark protection for that and not be infringing, you know, to the extent that the triple bypass has trademark rights in that if I don't call it something similar. So the idea, you know, that this is my race, I'm going from here to here to here to here, that really can't be protected as a trademark. It's the branding associated with that. So again, you might not be able to prevent somebody from doing an identical race. It's as long as they don't present it under a confusingly similar name, that's what the trademark protection provides, is preventing others from peddling on your reputation, your brand.
Yeah, I think there's actually a very interesting case here from races that puts across some of those points, and that's the Color Run. So the Color Run is a very popular series of races where people run a 5K or whatever, and they throw color powder at each other. You may have come across that. And basically, I was reading up on that, and to John's point about sort of like the format, protecting that color run format is not something you can do. You can say, you know, I will be the only race that is going to have exclusively is going to have that format where people run and throw color powder at each other. That's the first point. And then the other point to Suzanne's point earlier about use of names, I was actually reading about the color run that they did manage to trademark the name The Color Run. Although it sounds very generic for the type of race it is, it's almost like, you know, trademarking the trail run today or whatever. But they were able to do that because back in the day, the color run was sort of more like a brand rather than a format kind of thing. It wasn't generic enough and they managed to trademark it. Whereas if they hadn't, today, if you had like 10 color runs, they couldn't just go and say, I want to trademark the color run. Does that make sense?
It does. And we may be, you know, skipping ahead here a bit, but at least in the US, when you apply for a mark like that, and let's say, you know, it's somewhat descriptive. So as Suzanne alluded to earlier, you can't have a descriptive mark. So I can't say the race from, you know, Lethbridge to Calgary or, you know, wherever that might be. That's descriptive. If your mark is found to be descriptive when you file for the registration, you can show what's called secondary meaning in the US, where you demonstrate that even though the mark is descriptive, the consuming public has come to know that mark with your particular goods or services. The threshold to establish that secondary meaning is pretty high. It takes quite a bit of evidence to demonstrate that. But you can do that. Assuming you do have that brand recognition sufficiently established to provide that. The other thing that I would mention there is this also brings up potential genericide, it's called, which is when your mark, even if you have rights in your trademark, becomes so pervasively used that the consuming public stops associating that particular mark with your products. So, for example, there's a famous campaign in the US from the Velcro company, right? So it's Velcro is not a product. Velcro is a brand. It is a Velcro hook and loop fastener that they provide. And again, there've been a lot of diligent efforts there to try to avoid people calling all hook and loop fasteners Velcro under the fear that you would lose rights in that mark. So again, even if Color Run had protection, it could be that if it becomes so pervasively used, that becomes just a general descriptor of a format, you might actually lose rights if you had them at one point.
Another example of that is Google, that Google, unfortunately, has become a verb. Let's Google it, which is not, it's a search engine. It's a brand name of a search engine, but is slowly losing its distinctiveness because it is being used in incorrectly, improperly, in other ways. But and how would you ever enforce that? But going back to your question, Panos, about the color run too, there are exceptions to all of those rules. And as John mentioned, in the US, it's called secondary meaning. In Canada, we call it inherent distinctiveness. But there are circumstances where the brand has been used and has become so inherently distinct. So otherwise, people, when they hear it, associate it first with the brand as opposed to, for example, someone's name, that it can be registered. And Tim Hortons up here is a good example of that. It's obviously someone's name. He was a famous Canadian hockey player who opened a donut store, and it's now part of our culture, I would argue. But that's his name. So how did he protect that brand? Well, because we don't think of Tim Hortons maybe as the person anymore, but more so as the donut coffee shop instead. So he's become so inherently distinct as a brand that it is protectable.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. I mean, these are the subtleties that make this whole area so interesting. And we're going to get into all of those areas around precedent and usage and common law usage in a sec. Just explain to our listeners, if you may, what kind of geographies trademarks typically cover, particularly in places like in the US and Canada, where you have this kind of like federal type system. When I apply for a trademark, besides the distinction of what it is I'm protecting, where it is that I'm getting protection for?
This is where we differ quite a bit, I think. So the short answer, in Canada, we have a very simple system. It's a federal act. So our law is the Federal Canadian Trademarks Act. So if I file and protect a trademark in Canada, it covers you from sea to sea. It's a federal registration. We do not have provincial registrations.
So in the US, it depends, and I would say it gets complicated. First point that I'd like to make is, so for, and I think this holds true in Canada as well, trademarks are territorial, which is if I file a U.S. trademark or I have a U.S. trademark, that doesn't necessarily provide me any rights in Canada. So if I want to have protection in Canada, I might have to take specific steps in Canada to obtain protection for that. So it is, you know, a country by country determination at the broadest sense. In the U.S., primarily, so you mentioned common law. So in the U.S., trademark rights actually do accrue at common law, which is to say, in the U.S., you don't have to do anything other than begin to use your trademark in order to obtain rights in that trademark. But in the U.S., as you begin to use your mark, you only obtain rights in it to the extent that it becomes that source identifier and people associate your mark with your goods or services. So, you know, in the old days, it was a little bit, you know, more nuanced. So if I set up a storefront here in Denver, I might have notoriety within the Denver metro area, but somebody in New York or Florida or elsewhere in the country might have no idea about my brand, and I might not have protection in those areas. So at common law in the U.S., there was a geographic component to the extent of your brand recognition. With the internet, that's somewhat waned. You know, you put up a website and anybody across the country can typically access it, or across the world for that matter. The other consideration in the U.S. is that with a U.S. federal registration, when you file for that federal registration, you do get constructive nationwide use. So again, even if if I've only used the mark in a more limited geographic extent, if I filed for that federal registration, I do get constructive use. It's the U.S. treats it as if I've used it across the country pervasively when I file for that registration.
That's very interesting. And generally, I guess, in the context of an event, in the context of a local event, or even maybe a series that spans a few states, would the advice be people seek protection at a federal level or at a state level? Does it matter? Should they start with one and then broaden it out to the latter? How does it work?
So in the U.S., I would say, again, it depends upon the extent of the event. So the other kind of nuance in the U.S. is you can only obtain a federal registration for your trademark to the extent that you've used that mark in interstate commerce. So the U.S. Constitution is set up to where Congress, the federal legislature, can only pass laws to the extent that it affects interstate commerce. So if you organized a race and it was solely, those services were solely provided within a given state, and let's say you only had participants within that given state, you might not be eligible for federal protection of that trademark. However, even though, and again, as you alluded to, these races are, you know, they're geographically centric, right? I mean, if my race is in Vail, Colorado, that's where the race is going to be. But again, to the extent that you market outside of Colorado and have participants that, you know, let's say you have people coming in from all over the country in different states, that's typically sufficient to show that the mark is being used in interstate commerce, in which case you can obtain that federal registry, or at least try for that federal registration. It's the kind of use that would qualify.
So it's interesting. Let me clarify a point on what you said there. So if I try to apply for a federal trademark, there will also be an examination of whether I needed kind of like a federal trademark on merit, whether my products are interstate or not, and I may be denied it on those grounds?
That's correct. So in the U.S., when you apply for federal registration, it does go in front of an examining attorney at the United States Patent and Trademark Office, who will examine the trademark for a number of different requirements. But in the U.S., in order to obtain a federal registration, you have to demonstrate that the mark has been used in order to obtain that protection. And you can do that in a couple different ways. But unless and until you use the mark in commerce, interstate commerce in the U.S., you won't actually be granted a federal registration for that mark.
Since we're going into pretty nitty-gritty legal stuff in today's episode, have you ever wondered who owns the participant data in your registration platform? I mean, legally, who has the right to use the data your participants provide and how? Well, you may think that the answer is straightforward. You, as the race director, own the participant data for your race, and only you can use that data, right? Well, you may be surprised to hear that that is not always the case. Depending on the privacy policy of your registration platform and the legal agreement you have with them, your registration provider could also potentially be using your participant data to market other products to them, completely unrelated to your race, or even promote competing races to them. And I can tell you, that's a big deal and often super annoying for most participants. Well, RunSignup, a leader not only in technology but also in transparency, has a super simple policy on data usage. It's not very long, but it sort of says it all. Participants and races own their data. That means your participants will never receive promotions for other products or events, and they'll never see another race ad on your custom race website, ever. It's that straightforward. So, to learn more about RunSignup's leading all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events, make sure to visit runsignup.com. That's runsignup.com, where you'll also find full details of RunSignup's legal contract and privacy policy, both very easily accessible from the website's About Us section. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. Let's move on to another super fascinating topic I found when I was looking at trademarks, because I've sort of half been through this process with some of the stuff we did in the past, and that's common law trademarks, which John alluded to there, and it gave me great comfort when I came across them in thinking, oh, you know, I'm sort of half covered already. Does one of you want to sort of tell us a little bit about what common law trademarks are about?
Sure, I can speak to that and actually use Brian's marks as an example, because he or his predecessors, I should say, the company who used the marks before him, actually started using Death Race and Canadian Death Race to market the endurance race here in Alberta, up in Grand Cache, about 20 years ago. And they did so at common law, as John mentioned, just by using it. So that's why trademarks are great for, you know, startup companies or people who are just getting their product out to market. The more that you can stamp your logo and your name on your products and services, the better you are as far as your rights accruing. The day that you launch and you put your trademark out to the public is the date that you first use your brand, and that is the date that we use as far as protection at common law. That brand, even though you haven't taken the steps yet to register it federally in Canada and or state, as John mentioned, in the US, it is still legally enforceable. So 15 years ago, let's say, for example, I could not have started a competing race in the same line of trade as the Death Race, called it the Death Race, because then I would have been confusingly similar to the general public. And even though the mark was not registered, the Death Race trademark as an unregistered mark could have been used to make me cease and desist. So all of that long-winded, confusing way to say that an unregistered common law trademark is just as legally enforceable as a registered mark. The difference publicly that we ask clients to use to denote an unregistered trademark is the TM symbol, superscript symbol, at the end of the word or somewhere close to the logo. And that's typically enough to satisfy the courts that we've been using Death Race for 20 years. We've got our TM associated with that. And that's enough to then, if we ever needed to, enforce our brand. Then come fast forward 20 years. At some point, and I'm sure he'll speak to this, Brian decided to take the step to then register the marks. And that is, as John suggested, a formal application process where we prepare a trademark application that lists all the goods and services that you want to protect, that you want to cover in association with your brand. You file it at our Canadian Intellectual Property Office here in Ottawa, and it gets examined, as we've talked about, and then registered. And that's when you can use the R with the circle around it. So that's the difference between the TM and the R, is just that the person who has the R has taken the steps to register their brand in a national database here in Canada. I appreciate it's a bit different in the States. And that R is, you know, it has a time limit to it. It can be renewed, but it's just an added level of enforcement and notoriety, I guess, across the country.
So let's bring Brian actually in on this point. And I know the story behind the Death Race a little bit. It's fascinating, and how you took over it from another race director. As Suzanne said there, it's been a race for more than 20 years. And then you decided that the common law trademark protection was enough for you, I guess, and you decided to file for an actual trademark registration. What was the thinking behind that?
So we actually had one prior trademark for our other event, Sinister 7. And that was a process that started a couple years before, a year and a half maybe before I took over the Death Race. And so I purchased the intellectual property and all the goods and the goodwill of the event. So kind of everything associated with the event, I took over everything. And I knew right away that another event company had started to file the trademark for the name Death Race. And, you know, I will say there was no animosity or anything, but I really wanted to keep the name and be able to use it. And I talked to my trademark attorney at the time. That was not Suzanne. It was a different attorney at the time. And the advice was to proceed with it and that we would have prior usage because it had been around for so long and that we had sort of the upper hand in the eyes of the court and the eyes of the trademark office. And as soon as we filed, he turned around and said, well, no, that's actually false. That's not the way it works anymore. And so you don't have prior, whoever files first gets priority. So you have to kind of fight for it now, and you better fight for it if you want to keep the name, is what it came down to. And again, there was no, like I said, no animosity with myself and this other company. We didn't even speak, to be honest. I just really wanted to keep the name, and I wanted to make sure that we were able to keep using that brand. Because, you know, I took a lot of time and it took a lot of financial resources to take over that brand. And I wanted to make sure that we were able to get the most out of it that we could. Not exactly the same reason why we trademarked Sinister 7. That was more to do with the fact initially that we were seeing people who were trying to capitalize on our name. Like, hey, I'm going to put out a bunch of shirts and I'm going to, you know, put your name on it. Okay. I'm like, not really. Okay. But, you know, I felt at that time that in order to get really broad protection, because it was becoming a sort of a more known entity, I felt that we needed to take bigger steps. And that goes with both Death Race and Sinister 7. I thought we just needed to take those steps to really make sure that we were enforcing our claim to the brand and letting people know that, you know, it's not okay to just co-opt our goodwill and to get use out of that without our permission.
So for Death Race specifically, which is a super cool name, by the way, there's a few races in the US, a few Death Races in the US as well. Nice fun runs. And so for that one, was the idea that other company was trying to capitalize on the goodwill and the sort of like the recognizability of the original Death Race that you were running? Or did they sort of like independently wake up one day and they thought, you know, Death Race, that sounds cool. Let's put on a Death Race. And they tried to trademark that. And then they run into conflict with the existing race.
I would say it's definitely the latter. They weren't trying to capitalize on anything that we were doing. They just liked the name. Like you said, it's a great name. We're lucky to have it. So I think there was no concern on my side of them trying to pretend they were us. That's what wasn't what it was about at all.
No, that's my understanding as well, was that, and this is a good example of the jurisdictional line being drawn, where I understood that they actually did operate some death races in the US and then ultimately decided to branch out into Canada, not knowing perhaps or unbeknownst to them that there was already a death race operating here for 20 years. So that's going back to John's point, that you have to have the use in the jurisdiction where you want to seek the protection. Because if you don't, and there's somebody already using that name, even if you've had it in the States, you won't necessarily have success in Canada.
So a couple of years ago, we tried to trademark a series of events. Details are not important. And we approached a specialist firm doing trademarks. And one of the aspects of that service was actually running a common law trademark kind of like discovery thing, basically, right? Where they would actually, in the case of the Death Race, if I were that other person trying to register it, they would go out and they would Google it. I guess it's very simple these days. And they would actually see if there's other Death Races already trading under that name. How come that didn't come up in this case? Is that, John, something quite common in the US for the trademark process, to have this kind of like searches?
I would say it is common. It's not a requirement, for example, that you search before you file a trademark. The onus then goes to the examining attorney to determine that. And the other thing I should say is, with those trademark searches, sometimes it's more of a art than a science. And a lot of times there's budget considerations there. I mean, obviously there's a lot of products, there's a lot of services out there. Searching a database of the USPTO or the Canadian office may come back with results, but just searching in a few spots and trying to clear that mark as far as nobody else being used, that can be actually tricky. There could be people that are using the mark and it's just not super prevalent. They may still have some existing rights in that mark. So I would say it is common. And unfortunately, there's no such thing as a perfect search. So it can give you some good indications of whether there's likely issues with that mark. But I'd say it's oftentimes not a ironclad or a guarantee that there's not other people out there that don't have rights in that mark or adjacent rights, let's say, into a similar mark.
And in Brian's case, why should he have felt so concerned and felt like there was a race for registering the trademark when someone started the process, since he has been using that? I mean, he had common law protection for such a long time. You would have thought that he would have been covered, and still he felt like that wasn't enough when someone started actually registering a trademark against him.
Well, I think that's what ultimately led to the good news ending of this story, is that because Brian had such extensive use of the mark in association with endurance races, he was able to show the trademarks office that the newcomer coming into the jurisdiction shouldn't have those rights and he should. So what happened effectively is that even though Brian's trademark applications were filed after the other user by about 6 months, he was still ultimately able to oppose that earlier application based on his prior use and was successful at knocking them out to get registration of his marks. Did he have to take the steps of applying to register the mark? No, the results likely would have been the same, but it does go to the timing of when it's probably a good idea to take the steps to register the mark. I often say to clients, when you're just getting started, you're just getting off the ground, focus on getting your brand out there and getting your product out there, and use your time and effort and money on getting the product off the ground. 2, 3, 4 years from now, when you're making money and you're starting to see successes and you're thinking about branching out, maybe that's a time then to start thinking about taking the steps to register the brand. But going to the search question, is the search should be done before you launch, whether you're going to register or not. So that's still a good idea for anybody who has a logo or a slogan or something that they want to use.
For me, I put out little events all the time. You know, we're always trying a new thing. We'll pilot a new event almost every season. And before that, I do a search on the Canadian Trademark Database and in the US just to make sure that I'm not sort of stepping on anybody's toes. I don't want, not even just that, you know, hey, say there's one in the US that's similar. I just don't want anybody to think that I'm simply trying to steal their idea. It's not even a matter of me being worried about being sued. I just don't want to be seen as somebody who is trying to co-opt somebody else's intellectual property.
And actually, in the case of the death race, how was it that you were alerted to the fact that someone was trying to register that trademark? How did you come across that?
Somebody had mentioned it to me, but I always do searches on that kind of stuff fairly regularly. If, you know, that was one of the first things I did when I took it over. I did some due diligence on my own, and I did speak to my former attorney about that. And, you know, he did a search as well, and he found out for me. So we knew kind of right away that we were going to have to do something, whether it was filing or I didn't know at the time how we were going to handle it, but I knew that we had to do something to make sure that we were enforcing our ownership of the brand.
And Suzanne, if the competing trademark had been registered and, you know, Brian didn't have the good fortune of finding out before the application was accepted, where would Brian have been left after that?
That's a good question. And so because of this issue coming up all the time, there are certain time points during the application process where someone like Brian can oppose the application by the other party for that reason. There are lots of opportunities. I shouldn't say lots. There are two main opportunities where you can oppose, which is ultimately what we ended up doing. But let's say on the bad luck story that in fact they did get their death race trademarks registered for endurance races. They could ultimately enforce their registered mark by suing Brian for trademark infringement of his unregistered mark. The circumstance would play out in court, And ultimately, Brian would win because he has the date of first use. So even though they have a registered mark, the interesting twist to this story is that they had not yet used it in Canada. They had not run an event in Canada. And so they have no brand protection in Canada, effectively. Yes, they have a registered mark, so they are registered in our national database, but they have absolutely zero public awareness to support their brand. Whereas Brian, on the other hand, has 20 years of brand protection. You just don't ever want it to get to that point. I think that that's why the trademark office affords you these interim opportunities to oppose those pre-existing applications for that very reason.
And a big part of that too was, you know, at that time, looking forward, you could see these different endings sort of playing out. And a lot of them meant a lot of time in court and a lot of time spending money on trying to do retroactively defend what we were doing. And I just thought, you know, for me, it's more important to get out in front and to lead that charge instead of just trying to do it from the back end.
Which they probably understood. I mean, I can't speak to their side of things, but if I'm their trademark attorney looking at this story, I'm thinking we have no leg to stand on. And so ultimately what happened is we opposed their applications based on our prior use during the opposition period of the application process. And they effectively agreed to withdraw their applications.
Yeah, which ultimately, I guess, it's very comforting for people out there who are probably going to be on the defensive side of this to know that at the end of the day, if you've been trading on a brand name for a while and there's recognizability and you've established all that common law foundation, then you're in a pretty good spot, even if you weren't as fortunate as Brian to happen to come across like a competing trademark. I mean, obviously, it's not great if you have to drag yourself in court, but end of the day, you're going to come out the winner in this, which is really good. So moving on to the actual process, someone say, you know, as Suzanne says, it shouldn't be your first priority because you first need to establish the brand and trade under it, and you shouldn't even worry about this. Definitely do a search to see if you're infringing on someone else's trademark potentially, but assume you start trading and at some point, like Brian with Sinister 7, you want to move on to a formal registration process. What does the process look like in the US, John, for something like that, if you want to register a trademark?
Yeah. So in the US, I believe it's a little bit different than Canada. And actually, to kind of piggyback on what Suzanne said, there is actually a motivation in the US possibly to consider filing for a registration, even if you are just getting off the ground. And that is, in the US, when we file a trademark application, there's several different bases that you can file under in the US. And that's basically, this is the statement of the reason why you're entitled to the mark. So in the US, you can file what's called a use-based application, where kind of following that model Suzanne noted, you know, you've been using your mark, you're using it in commerce, you've had sales, you've got some notoriety, and you file for a federal registration. At that point, you can go to the USPTO and present what are referred to as specimens of use, where we show, hey, this is how my branding appears to consumers. This is how I've been using it. And I've been using it as early as some date. The other option in the US, or one of the other options, is to file what's called an intent to use mark. So in the US, as I alluded to earlier, you have to use your mark in interstate commerce in the US prior to obtaining a registration. But in the US, you can obtain some priority to your mark with that intent to use mark. So if I haven't begun to actually use the mark in the US yet, I can still file for a registration where I say that I have a bona fide intent to use this mark in commerce in the US. And that US mark, when we file it with USPTO, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, does still provide that constructive nationwide use. So again, even though I haven't used it, I can establish some priority, which in the US, I would say, provides some motivation to consider potentially filing for a registration, even if you haven't begun to use it in the US, because you can still get some priority rights there. And kind of, again, going back to Brian's story, that priority right can streamline the process and avoid having to go through opposition proceedings or cancellation proceedings to a second junior user that tries to trademark it before you, or tried to register it before you do. Again, if you get kind of crossed paths there where you've been using it before some other party, but they try to register it before you've begun to register it, it does get messy and it can get very complicated and costly. So considering that early registration sometimes in the US as an intent to use mark can somewhat circumvent those issues.
So this is almost, I guess, like saying this intent to use mark that there's like cryptocurrency boom. I have an idea of launching a company called Coinbase. Then some other guy has the idea of launching a company called Coinbase. And if I file this intent to use mark, even though none of those companies still trade, I'm sort of ahead of other pretenders when it comes to the actual trademark. I'm sort of like, I have a slight precedence over them.
Exactly. Yes. The priority is established based on your intent to use filing dates. And the idea in the US there is, you know, once you file your registration in the US, even as it's still pending, it becomes publicly available. So any junior user or second comer, let's say, that wants to use their mark, the idea is that mark, even though the registration hasn't been issued yet, is still publicly available in the search, so that if I'm going out and starting my cryptocurrency business or a race or whatever product I'm going to search, I can see that mark is pending and basically come into that mark knowing that somebody else has a senior intent to use that mark, which again would be hopefully discovered in a search before starting to use your mark. Continuing that process in the US, so once you file your federal registration, application for federal registration, as I mentioned, it gets assigned to an examining attorney that then reviews it for both formalities and as well as substantive issues in the US. So is the mark descriptive? Are there prior uses, prior, you know, US registrations or applications for registrations that your mark would be confusingly similar in view of? Are there geographically descriptive terms at issue here? Those different requirements are examined by the U.S. examining attorney. Assuming you can get through all of those hurdles, it's not descriptive. There's not prior marks out there. Then again, if you filed an intent to use mark, what you do is you receive a notice of allowance in the U.S. And at that point, you have a certain period of time to then come back and say, okay, now that this mark's been allowed, I'm actually using it. I've begun use in the U.S., interstate use, and here's how I'm using it and showing that evidence to the USPTO. That period of time, you get an initial 6-month period that is extendable out to a maximum of 3 years. So there is a time horizon if you have that intent to use application. There's the pendency till it first gets examined up to your notice of allowance. Once you receive your notice of allowance, you have 3 years to then show use. So, you know, if you're filing an intent to use mark and you're not going to use it for 5 or 6 years down the road, you know, that can be problematic. But as long as you're going to begin use within that, you know, 3 plus or minus 6 months, let's say, time period, that intent to use mark can cover you and you can still obtain your registration.
Suzanne, does the process follow similar patterns in Canada?
It does. As I mentioned, have a relatively new Trademarks Act, so it has been revised, where we did have different bases of application that John is talking about. That has now been removed effectively. So you can file your trademark in Canada now, whether you have actually used it or whether you do intend to use it. There is no timeline per se as to how long after your mark is registered that you have to use it if you file on an intent to use basis. But there are circumstances. So as we've alluded to, the whole point of a trademark is to get it out there and get the public recognition and build that goodwill and build that brand. And so, as John says, if you haven't done so after a certain amount of time, there are processes under our act by which people, junior users who want to come in and use those marks can question you. They can say, hey, have you started using it? And if not, why not? Or alternatively, ask that the registrar remove your mark if you haven't used it. If, for example, for a period of 3 years and you can't prove that you've used it, then it's not really fair that you get the exclusive rights to it. So you can be removed from the register for that purpose.
And the process generally, how long does it take from starting to file for a trademark until a decision is arrived at by the PTO or other office you guys have in Canada?
So before COVID, it was a lot faster. Unfortunately, we are dealing with a significant backlog right now because of COVID and because of our act being revised. So there are many more applications being filed and there are not enough examiners there to review the files. So currently, if I were to prepare and file a trademark application for you today, there are some things that we can do to get it through a little bit faster, but relatively speaking, we wouldn't hear back from a trademarks examiner who has now reviewed the file for at least 2 years, probably closer to 3 years. Then you have a certain timeline to respond to the examiner's letter. So they'll send us a letter saying various comments. For example, they might reject the description of the race. They want a more detailed description. Well, what do you mean by endurance race? And so you have to then respond to that letter. You have a certain amount of time to do so. And that back and forth can go on. They're trying to limit that back and forth as much as they can, but it can go on for 6 months, 9 months, a year. And then once you get allowed by the examiner, so we've agreed to the terms, the description of the goods and services, we don't think the mark has any issues, the examiner will issue a notice of allowance. And at that point, the mark then gets advertised in a trademarks journal. So every Thursday, the Canadian Intellectual Property Office releases a trademarks journal of all the marks that have now been allowed. And a 2-month opposition period starts. So for someone like Brian, he can check that journal every week and say, are there any other death race related marks out there or marks that I have issue with? And at that point, oppose it. If you do oppose it, that kind of derails the application process and takes it offline into a sort of a trademarks opposition process. But if you don't get opposed after the 2-month advertisement period, the mark then gets granted and you pay a registration fee and it's good for 10 years. And then you can effectively renew it every 10 years indefinitely, provided that you're still using it.
John, is that the case in the US 2-3 years now after COVID to go through the process?
The process is very similar in the U.S. Fortunately, in the U.S., we don't have quite the same backlog that Canada does. I think that the USPTO is still currently over their target to first action. And currently, we're around 7 months. So if we were to file a U.S. federal application for registration today, we wouldn't get that first action from the examining attorney for about 7 months, as opposed to the 2 or 3 years that Suzanne was alluding to. And then at that time, the process is very similar. So similar to Canada, 7 months from now, when the examining attorney picks up the application and reviews it, they'll, again, substantively review it for all of the issues. If there's a problem, you'll receive an office action. And again, you have that back and forth where we either amend the description or argue different points with the examining attorney. Again, then we receive, if it's an intent to use application, we would receive a notice of allowance. If it was a use-based application, it would simply publish. But in either instance, like Suzanne alluded to, the U.S. has we call it the official gazette that the U.S. PTO publishes. And I believe ours is on Tuesday rather than Thursday. But in the U.S., we have a 1-month initial opposition period where if within that 1-month period, nobody opposes the registration as advertised. Then again, if it's a use-based application, it proceeds to registration because you've already demonstrated that you've been using the mark. If it's an intent to use application, after that 1-month period expires and there's no oppositions, you would receive a notice of allowance and then again have that initial six-month period that's extendable to supplement your application with evidence that you've used the mark, show the office, this is how we're using our trademark, and we've been using it as of such and such a date. Similarly, in Canada, if you are opposed, if there's another user out there that believes that they have a legitimate reason why you shouldn't have that registration, that also, in our case, does derail that process and moves it into a proceeding before the U.S. Trial and Trademark Appeal Board, where that opposition would be heard. And I think it's similar to Canada. In the U.S., that very much turns into kind of a mini trial. It's an administrative proceeding, so it's not like you're in court per se. It's an administrative court, but it does become kind of adversarial at that point, and it's us versus them, and that's where all the arguments are heard to determine who has the rights in that mark.
Did you know that in a recent survey, 73% of responders said that reading reviews influences which races they enter? Well, RaceCheck is the largest aggregator of race reviews in the world and has collected over 40,000 race reviews for over 6,000 events globally. So how can you collect more reviews for your event and make the most of them to increase your race registrations? Well, you can start by listening to our Power of Race Reviews podcast from September 20th last year. There's plenty of tips there on growing your race reviews. And then visit organizers.racecheck.com. That's organizers with an S, .racecheck.com to download your free RaceCheck review box so you can start showing all your race reviews on your website for an instant boost to your race's social proof and conversions. It really is a no-brainer, so go to organizers with an S, .racecheck.com and download your free RaceCheck review box today. Okay, Now, let's get back to the episode. Brian, do you remember in your case for the Sinister 7 trademarks and for Death Race, how long the process took?
Mine were not shiny examples. You know, I was told at the time when I started the Sinister 7 trademark process that it would be probably 18 months if it went nice and clean. Unfortunately, Phil, my former attorney, was a little bit on the haphazard and kind of lazy side. And so things didn't seem to get done. It was lots of, I forgot to file this. I got to go ask for an extension now, and on and went like that. Although there were no oppositions to it or anything, it just seemed to take over 2 years. The Death Race one, because of all the complications, took about 4 years in the end. And we switched attorneys to Suzanne about halfway through the process, maybe not quite halfway through the process.
Are you in liberty to disclose, just to give people an idea, how costly the process had been for you in its case?
You know what? I don't even recall now. It was just definitely a few thousand dollars for the first one. I mean, there were two trademarks for the second. So there was a filing fee. The legal fee wasn't that much different, just because there were two being done simultaneously, Death Race and Canadian Death Race. It wasn't outrageous. I would say that, you know, because I was dealing with two different attorneys, it did cost a bit more. That's just a part of the process. You know, it was my choice to switch attorneys partway through. So I had already paid all the initial fees to the one and then had to do a lot of that over again later. So to me, it was more worth it to get it done and defend, make sure I was taking care of my brands, than it was to worry about a few thousand dollars here and there.
And in the end, did you end up trademarking the name and the logo and other stuff in its case? What bits did you trademark from the events?
Just the names of each one.
Just the names. Okay, so you weren't concerned about trademarking. Would that, Suzanne, be something that you advise people in Brian's case to basically not bother with logos and other stuff, just go for the name?
Well, and that's something maybe we should have spoken to a bit more at the outset, but how do you know what to trademark in terms of your brand and your slogan, et cetera? The way that it typically works is that the word mark, which is just the words Death Race, is usually broader in scope of protection than a logo would be. So if Brian uses the words Death Race, just as the words, then the brand is protected. If he incorporates them into a logo, they are also ultimately protected, not as a registered trademark granted, but there is still protection there afforded by incorporating your words into your logo. Whereas the logo is a bit more limited in scope, in the sense that if you decide to rebrand or if you change your logo or update it in any way, the logo registration is no longer valid. And that happens quite a bit when companies decide to rebrand. So the word mark is usually where we start. I typically say that's where you want to focus your time and effort. If you have a logo, though, that you're tied to and really love and you know you're going to use it for at least 10 years, then certainly it can be worth doing both. So they would be two separate registrations covering the same goods and services, but two different assets ultimately for the company at the end.
And the other thing I think we should have mentioned is that there's also different categories, right? So in terms of trademarking even a word mark. So, you know, I can have the name Bolt and it can be trademarked under different categories and different kind of like types of products, right? It doesn't mean that if I trademark Bolt, no one else can use Bolt. You know, I may have a race called Bolt and the other guy has running store even, which people may think is fairly similar, but it's not even the same thing. My trademark doesn't basically have any bearing on what someone else does in a different category, right?
That's right. And we call that the lines of trade. And so when we draft a trademark application for a client, we refer to this international categorization of goods, or what they call the NIS classification of goods and services. So there are about 34 categories of products that we are supposed to sort of tie into and use as a basis for drafting the goods and services. And then there are about 10 categories of services. So if I have Bolt for endurance races and you have Bolt for a shoe store, they may be in different categories of goods and therefore are not as likely to be confusingly similar to the public. It's not your only line of defense that if you're in different categories, there's no confusion. That's not necessarily true. a shoe store can still be confusing with endurance races if the public is confused. That's always our bottom line is does the person know when they're signing up for the race that it's not affiliated with the shoe store? But there are ways that you can describe those lines of trade or the goods and services so that you differentiate yourself from others for that reason.
The same in the US, right? So I think it is important to note that in the US, the scope of your trademark protection is still determined by what is confusingly similar to the public. So while as Suzanne said, while the classes can be helpful and while the offices, both Canada and the US, use those kind of organizational purposes, as an example, in the US, the filing fees are based on the number of classes that you're in. So if you file for, let's say, one class of services for organization of the race and another class for apparel for, you know, merchandise that goes along with the race, those two different classes are going to require two different filing fees. And so the U.S. Often will use that for kind of organizational purposes. That being said, if it's in a different class, if it's confusingly similar, and the consuming public is confused, there still can be infringement. It's not a defense to say, oh, that's different class than what I'm doing. You have to look at the facts and see whether it's confusing.
And this is sort of what happened with you, Brian, right? In Sinister 7, because you said that the motive behind pursuing that was that people wanted or started printing shirts with the race logo on it. Was that the case?
Yeah, we were seeing all kinds of stuff like that. You know, manufacturers, small manufacturers saying, oh, you know, I'm going to print a line of shirts sort of on behalf of you. I'm like, well, what do I get out of it? Oh, well, you know, don't you want me to be successful kind of thing? Yeah, but, you know, I think I need to be successful too out of that deal. So that kind of stuff was starting to happen. We had my former partner and I, we had a big talk about it, and we just decided it was a good time to make sure that we were taking those steps. And then, you know, we could have something to point to and say, look, you know, if you want to do this, you got to talk to us. You can't just assume it's okay. You know, I think it was the right choice. We have since been able to say in a number of occasions when approached by people saying, you know, hey, can I do X, Y, Z? I want to manufacture this thing for you, or I want to brand this thing with your event. And we can say, look, you know, we just have to come up with a use agreement, and you need to pay us X amount of money. And it's really straightforward, you know, and this is, you know, what we have to do now. It's actually deterred a lot of people who were kind of just like, hey, I want to make a bunch of like coasters or something for you. And, you know, which is nice to kind of get that hassle off my plate a little bit, but it's also been really great for larger companies that we've partnered with. And, you know, we have an understanding of how we're going to work together. And it's very straightforward. You know, I don't at all regret going through this process by any means. I think it was the right thing to do.
So you mentioned there that, you know, people may approach you to use your brand on your behalf, and you may agree to that. What's the legal sort of regime in something like that? Would you be licensing that, or like give someone the right to use a trademark, or like how would that work?
Well, you know, and like both John and Suzanne have said, you know, you can do a lot of that through the common law, and perhaps, you know, the trademark wasn't necessarily required for these things, but I wanted the legal protection. And so what we ended up doing is we worked with another attorney to create a brand use agreement. Basically, we set up the parameters of where it can be used, how it can be sold, how much we get out of it, and any other details. You know, if it's going to be, hey, you're doing graphics and you're going to sell them out of your shop, you know, here's how we monitor getting our percentage, and here's where your trade area is. And, you know, here is the limit of that, like, you can print shirts, but not hats, because somebody else may have the right to print hats for us, you know. And we really get down to granular detail to describe the kind of stuff that they're allowed to do. We like to work preferably, you know, with broader strokes. Like, we like to have somebody who can do more for us than less, but at the same time, you know, it's helped us to, you know, we just end up getting these vendors that can do a lot for us. And, you know, they have very good parameters, and there's no guesswork. So we have a really nice little brand use agreement that we sign with everybody. And even if somebody wants to just do some free shirts to wear at the race just for them and their family, I still have an agreement with them. It's just, it's maybe a no cost agreement, but it states that, hey, you're not selling these, you made them for yourself. And I have said that's okay, because it's like, you know, it'd be really hard to sue me for printing a shirt that said Xerox on it and just wearing it around, right? I'm not really worried about that. I'm really worried about people that are trying to capitalize on sales. And it also goes back to the brand confusion. You know, something that's happened in the last little while, last couple of years on social media is we get people signing up for our Facebook groups and pages, and they start to post, oh, hey, you know, I'm making these shirts now and it has our logo, and they're obviously scammers, right? So you get those kind of characters as well. So it makes sense to make sure that we have everything covered.
Yeah, we're going to move into enforcement in a second. You tell us what you do with those scammers, Brian. Before we get there, I had a question for everyone, because I know, I mean, Race Directors, Brian would know that better than anyone. They are a thrifty bunch. I guess, theoretically, the option is open to everyone to go through the process themselves, I guess, right? Is that right? You don't need formally to engage with a lawyer. You can file for a trademark as an individual. What's your thoughts on this one? And I want everyone's reaction on this one. I guess, starting with Brian, is that something you even considered doing? Looking back on it, would you have done it?
I started out Sinister 7 years ago, filing it myself. And I thought, hey, I can probably handle this. And you know what? I failed at the first step because I didn't remember to do XYZ for the next step. And it's a lengthy process. And I feel that an attorney, having a good lawyer that can do this for you is actually really valuable. It's something that I don't want to be managing necessarily. And we started out trying to trademark the logo. And we thought that was enough at the time, but it ultimately failed and it was rejected. And I think I actually filed two different forms. One had different dates than the other. And so they immediately just said, well, no, this isn't right. And it all came back to me after a few months. And they said, your application's rejected. And I didn't do anything on it. And it was expunged. So that was that. And then we started officially with an attorney, and it actually went relatively smooth.
I guess I know your answers, guys, but let's have them. John, Suzanne, should people do this on their own?
You know, I agree with you. You can, right? So you can file what's called a pro se, where you know you just file with the USPTO. Again, yeah, I personally would recommend it. And my thought there is, you know, I understand that, you know, race directors, like a lot of entrepreneurs who are in startups, are, you know, very frugal and have to be in order to be successful. One thought is, typically, you know, an application for trademark registration is not terribly expensive. You know, and I know that's relative for everyone, but I would say that the costs, as Brian kind of alluded to, for doing it incorrectly, even if you have to file twice, you know, if you have to file twice, that typically covers, you know, almost probably the cost of the attorney to do it right in the first place. And also, you know, I think the attorney brings in possibly a bigger, you know, broader context where you can consider things that you might not as an individual, to either get a broader scope of protection or maybe more rational protection, right? Something that makes a little more sense for what you're doing, what your goals are. And again, it's not, you know, it's not a $10,000 process by any stretch of the imagination to get that, you know, assuming things don't go wrong. The other issue there is if things do start to spiral, you have a senior user that you encounter, you know, your attorney, I think, can provide you some very, I think, probably common sense or not common sense, but some good feedback on, you know, relative costs, what the process looks like moving forward. And it gives you that input then to make a decision. Well, gee, should we change our name? Should we consider a different brand? You know, is it going to be more cost effective to maybe pivot and rebrand than it would be to needlessly fight oppositions or cancellations or any of these other, you know, litigation type or litigation adjacent type activities? That can just be a huge money sink, frankly. So again, I think an attorney, again, it's not going to be, I wouldn't say prohibitively expensive, given the alternatives out there. And if you do run into problems, you know, I think you get very good feedback and likelihood of success and whether it makes sense to pursue it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree and echo everything that John and Brian have said. I think it's better to have the knowledge and spend a bit of money upfront and do it properly than to have to deal with the corrections and the mistakes that occur down the line. I know in Canada, I think it's the same in the United States. We have to pass a trademarks exam in order to be qualified to do this. So you may not even need a lawyer necessarily, but I do urge individuals who are interested in getting more information about trademarks in Canada to at least speak to a trademark agent. And our Canadian Intellectual Property Office database, the website has a list of every registered trademark agent in Canada. And there's no harm in picking up the phone and calling a few of them. I know most of us don't charge for initial cold calls to just answer questions, but what's the difference between the TM and the R? How much does it cost to file? What's a NIST classification? What should I be considering? So even just to get you through the gate as a starting point, I think it's worth trying to at least get more information and speak to a trademarks agent. And I echo what John's saying too. As far as costs go, the application fee in Canada is $335 for one category of goods. And over and above that, you're maybe looking at an hour of attorney time to prepare the application for you. So it shouldn't be too much money if you only, you know, if you limit what you're protecting. If you want everything under the sun, then maybe it's going to be a bit more as far as fees go. But there are ways to minimize those costs and to think about doing it properly.
And once I have my trademarks in, what should I be thinking about in terms of renewing or using them, you know, just to protect them against lapsing? Perhaps does that even happen with trademarks? Can they lapse over time?
In Canada, they do. They're good for if you have a registered mark. So common law, no. As long as you continue to use the mark, you maintain your protection with the goods and services that you continue to use. So there may be some, maybe I don't sell mugs anymore, but I still have water glasses or water bottles. So there may be goods or categories of goods and services that have lapsed because you haven't used them within a certain amount of time. But as long as you continue to use the brand, you should be okay. For a registered mark, it is good for 10 years from the date of registration, and then you pay a renewal fee to keep it going for another 10 years. So again, as long as you continue to use it and want to continue to protect it, that's all you need to do. It's a pretty straightforward process.
Similar story in the US. Yeah, the one difference in the US is we have an initial 5-year renewal period in the US where you have to renew at a 5-year anniversary from your registration. But one of the other primary, I say, benefits of a federal registration in the US is at that 5-year period, you can actually petition for what's called incontestability, which means if somebody then tries to challenge your mark, let's say based on their own prior use, and say that you were never entitled to that registration because they were using that mark before you were, if they try to do so after you petitioned and been accepted for that incontestability status, their options to do that are very limited. You know, it's almost a, you know, you have 5 years to speak or forever hold your peace, kind of as the saying goes, right? If you don't oppose or try to cancel that mark in that period, and you didn't achieve that incontestability status, you can severely limit the third party's abilities to contest your mark. So that's a benefit. Then once that 5-year period lapses, like Canada, the US, it's 10-year anniversaries from your registration date where you have to, in the US, demonstrate that you're continuing to use the mark with a specimen and make it a statement that it's still in use. And at that point, it renews for another 10 years.
And in terms of the symbols that are being used that Suzanne alluded to there, we have the R in the little circle, which is for registered trademarks. And then we have just the TM, which anyone can use for common law trademarks. Is that right so far?
That's correct. Yeah, the TM in the US is basically providing notice to the public that you believe that that's a trademark. So it doesn't mean that you've done any research or even that, you know, that you definitively have common law rights in that. It's an indicator that you believe that that's a trademark and that you're intending to use it in a trademark sense. The circle R is for registration. I would also say that, you know, once you get your registration, we typically provide counsel to clients on how to use the mark. You know, as we alluded to earlier, there's genericide, there's other issues that can crop up. You know, if you, you know, as example, and Susan, I think, said this earlier, right? The mark is a descriptor of the goods or services. It is not a good. It is not a service itself. So it's the death race endurance race, right? Endurance race is the type of event, and death race is the name of the event. Similarly, you know, for goods, it's a, you know, a death race branded water bottle, you know, not a death race bottle. And that usage can be very important as far as maintaining your mark and using it in a proper way.
So is there any actual benefit for race directors out there starting slapping TM on everything that they think might be a common law trademark? Or actually, to put it another way, Is there any downside or not using that TM symbol? What does it practically do?
Yeah, practically, there's really no, you know, there's no reason not to use it. I would caution you, if you use the circle R and you don't have a registration, that's referred to as false marking, and that can you know, get you in trouble. But the TM, again, is just a designator that you believe there's a trademark there. So again, if you're starting a race up and let's say you don't want to invest in a registration, you know, use that TM and use it consistently and continuously throughout, you know, all your materials and your marketing. And that can really help bolster those common law uses that you have.
That's a good point, actually, about using the R with the circle, is that legally you are not allowed to use that unless you have a registered mark. So that's a good point, John, and something that probably should be clearly stated, that it's not just as easy as putting the R with the circle up. You do have to have a legally registered trademark in order to use that symbol. So the TM comes in handy for those that don't. I think the risk of slapping it up all over is perhaps just thinking through the what it is that you're branding. So again, Brian's Endurance Races is not a TM. The logo or the slogan or the unique way that you are marketing your company, the source of the goods and services to the public, is what's the TM. So we all know the apple with the bite out of it is one of the most valuable logos in the world. It has nothing to do with the hardware or software that company sells. It's completely obscure and unique and random and has nothing to do with what the company sells. So that's one tidbit that I do say to clients is come up with something that is completely random, completely made up, and that's your TM. That's what you wanna use.
And just to clarify before we move on, the registered R in a circle symbol can only be used once the trademark has been granted, right? Once the process has been completed. Even if you're in process, you can't be using that.
That's correct.
Yep.
Hey there. Last interruption from me, and I'll make it quick, I promise. I wanted to tell you, if you didn't know already, about us, Race Directors HQ, the people behind this podcast. You probably have been listening to this podcast for a while, and maybe you're also a member of our Race Directors Hub group on Facebook. But did you know that all this is curated and lovingly brought to you by our team at Race Directors HQ? Race Directors HQ is the team that brings you all the resources and tools you need to help you better plan, promote, and grow your race. We have tons of free, in-depth resources for you, whatever your level of expertise, at racedirectorshq.com. And we have an amazing membership program that can help you achieve even more with automated race calendar listings, an online sponsor finder tool, and exclusive vendor offers to save you money on all your race supply needs. So when you're done listening to this podcast, don't forget to visit racedirectorshq.com. That's racedirectorshq.com. And take a look at our awesome free resources and our industry-leading Race Director membership program. Okay, back to the episode. I want to wrap up, and it's been a super interesting discussion so far, with a quick discussion on actually defending trademarks and resolving disputes. We had the example of the death race, which fortunately was resolved before even the trademark was granted. But Brian, you were mentioning earlier all those cases, and I see instances of this being mentioned in our Race Directors group as well, of people on social media trying to capitalize on the brand and trying to sell things on behalf of a brand you own and a trademark you own. Have you had to defend one of your trademarks more robustly than just telling people, just stop using that?
Yeah, the company that filed the initial trademarks for Death Race has subsequently filed a new trademark for another variation of Death Race. And we've sent them a cease and desist to let them know that we are going to defend this. So you might as well stop right now.
Okay, great.
And some small things here and there, you know, where we said, look, you know, by the way, you can't do that. And they apologized right away and stopped. So it hasn't gone as far as having to write an actual cease and desist letter in most cases. But yeah, it has come up.
But generally, I guess, from the legal professional's point of view, the first step would be to just tell someone to stop using the trademark, basically, that if you feel they're sort of like infringing on your own. Is that the idea?
That is the idea. And as John mentioned with the Velcro situation, you want it to be hook and loop. You don't want your name used by companies who are not allowed to use it. And if you don't take those steps to enforce it, that's ultimately what can occur. And it is often just as simple as writing a cease and desist. 9 times out of 10, companies don't want the public to be confused by the source of the goods. They want their brand to be protected and they want their goods to be associated with their company. So, you know, unless it's a circumstance of a company clearly trying to steal that goodwill and to infringe on that trademark, they will ultimately cease and desist. And it comes down to that date of first use, who had it first. And there are lots of ways to settle it out before you go to court. So in circumstances where, you know, as Canada's a big country, let's say we have somebody in Alberta, Western Canada, that has been using a mark in association with a particular good, decides to start to brand across the country and finds out there's somebody on the East Coast that has also been using it. Unbeknownst to each other, and they value each other's companies, and it's not to say that they want to necessarily prevent each other from using the marks. We can create agreements that allow both trademark owners, registered or unregistered, to coexist in Canada. So for example, Company A is allowed to continue using the mark in association with the goods and services in Western Canada, but they won't ever go into Eastern Canada and vice versa. So there are ways to settle it out and to handle it, but you do have to take that first step of writing that cease and desist to get to that stage.
And I would echo that and say there's a lot of options for enforcement short of suing somebody. And I've found that the more you have your T's crossed and I's dotted and your kind of your house in order, have a registration, you have evidence of use, you have evidence, documenting when you first started using the mark, if you have all of this, and again, it's not super complicated. It's more just kind of record keeping and being thoughtful of these issues. That tends to help when you go to either send a cease and desist or contact a competitor or somebody that's using the mark and say, hey, you need to stop. Or if you have to go to the next step and file an opposition proceeding against somebody that's filed or file a cancellation. Again, all that evidence is very helpful either in the proceeding itself or to demonstrate to the other party that they're frankly in the wrong. The other thought there is, and again, I don't know if it's maybe as applicable to the race directors just because it's a different kind of channel of trade, but there's also non-judicial solution. So for example, if you start to see Death Race t-shirts on Amazon, Amazon has a process where you can say, I have a registered trademark in Canada if it's Amazon.ca or the US if it's Amazon.com. And this person's selling and they're not authorized to do that. And Amazon can actually enforce that. It typically requires demonstration of your rights through a registration. So again, that registration, even if you don't ever intend to sue anybody, can be valuable for those, extrajudicial whether it's Amazon or eBay or domain registries, for that matter. If somebody has a website that's selling infringing goods, sometimes, if you contact the domain registry, you can take steps short of litigation, which frankly is costly and long, right, timeframe, to take some steps there to enforce your mark.
And I think one of the very important points that you brought up that I think we should stress once more is that when there is an instance of infringement, whether it's intentional or otherwise, it is very important at that point to defend the trademark. Your ownership and continued sort of, ability to gain the benefits of having the trademark rely on you being very robust in defending your rights, right?
Correct. And, piggybacking on Suzanne's point about coexistence, for example, if you become aware of that East Coast company that's using a similar, confusingly similar mark, you might say, oh, that's not an issue. We're not going to take any action there. That can actually hurt you later because somebody else that you do have an issue with can point to that other company and say, look, that person's been using it. So therefore, your rights aren't as strong as you say they are. If you have that a coexistence agreement or that agreement that says, hey, this is the understanding of all the parties. They're going to use it in these provinces or in this geographic extent. I'm going to use it here or in this manner for these goods. You can point to that agreement to say, look, we've been actively policing our mark. It's sometimes referred to as policing that enforcement action. We've been actively policing our mark. And yeah, they're using it, but it doesn't degrade our rights at all because we're all on the same page. We have a very clear understanding of what their rights are, what our rights are. And so if a third party comes along, they can't point to that other use if it's if it's covered under that agreement where everybody's on the same page is what's happening.
Yeah, very important. So I guess we're saying that you should probably err on the side of caution, and even with those cases of coexistence, try to document it. And as John, as you said, it even sort of like adds to your ammunition when it comes to it to actually say that, you know, we do have a formal agreement between us. And that basically builds on your case that you're trying to defend the trademark. Guys, this has been, I can't think we've left anything out. Maybe if you do, we should mention it now. One thing I want from you guys is to just tell our audience where they can find more about you and the services you offer, and maybe follow up with you if they have any need for any trademarking or any other kind of like intellectual property services from the both of you, John and Suzanne.
As I said, the firm I'm with is Holzer Patel Drennan. Our website is www.hpdlaw.com. And that provides contact information and I think a link to email if you had any follow-up questions. My contact information can be found there, as well as kind of my background and biography.
The law firm I work with is a regional firm in Southern Alberta called North & Company, North like the direction, and our website is just northandcompany.com. And as John mentioned, you can find my information there. But just generally speaking, I think it's important to know that any trademark agent is of value and of service. And if you're looking for somebody in Alberta or Western Canada, I'd be happy to answer any questions or pick up the phone and speak to you directly. But anywhere you are, find somebody who's qualified and has a bit more information than just the general info about any intellectual property. So we've obviously focused on trademarks, but John and I both also do patents, copyright, industrial design, or design patents, as they're called in the United States, as well as other forms. So we'd be happy to chat to anybody who has any other questions.
Of course. I mean, they can use everyone, but I suggest they use you guys because you were so generous with your time and so clear with your answers. Brian, besides Raise Directors Hub or Raise Directors Group, where else can people find you? Do you have an email maybe if they want to reach out? Anything that you may have said around your experiences with trademarking maybe has resonated with someone? How can they reach you?
Yeah, the best is just to go to our website at sinistersports.ca. You can reach me at info@sinistersports.ca.
Awesome. Guys, thank you very much all for your time today. It's been awesomely entertaining and educational. I want to thank you again. I want to thank everyone listening in, and we'll see you all on our next podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode on race trademarking with my guests, Sinister Sports, Brian Gallant, and intellectual property lawyers, John Deppy and Suzanne Shovold. You can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. And you can also share your questions about race trademarks or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. Many thanks again to our awesome podcast sponsors, Run Sign Up and Race Check, for sponsoring today's episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player and check out our podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, take care and keep putting on amazing races.